hurricane is here, we're just blowing stuff around. So an interesting question is, what kind of velocity does it take to go into the skin, through the skin?
That's an interesting question that I don't have the faintest idea about, but yeah. I mean, ultimately, it depends upon the force. You know, how many pounds per square inch over a very, very small surface area are you pushing it? At some point, the fabric of your skin just lets go and lets anything go through it. So that'll be an interesting thing to look up. It probably isn't something easily Googleable, but I always like a challenge. I've never used a pneumonic injector. As you mentioned, that's kind of wholesale medicine. You know, when you got 100 or 200 people lined up and you're just kind of zapping them. Although, you know, in regular civilian life, you know, with the vaccinations, no one would have the nerve to use a pneumatic needle. It'd be a little bit too abrupt for most people. But I've seen them in movies. I've never really used them. They're not something that general practitioners tend to have much experience with.
Well, I can tell you've never been through boot camp. No, I haven't either, but my brother was, and he told me it was quite a memorable experience. But here's a relevant point. If that was true, if you put your hand right up against the end of at the nozzle, it would draw blood.
Well, I don't know if draw blood, because it's going in the wrong direction. It would screw you up. I mean, there are lots of equipment. I think grease guns have misfired and injected grease into someone's arm, much to everyone's chagrin, and it required surgery to open and size and drain it and such. So there are a lot of tools capable of disrupting and going right past the skin layer.
Yeah, but grease guns operate at a fairly high pressure. There's a huge mechanical advantage to pressurizing the grease that I'm not seeing in an aerosol can.
Easy to feel.
Jeff, recognize that. I just want to say, once again, I completely understand your suspicions, and I had them early into the YouTube. I kind of thought to myself, how is this guy going to prove the velocity of air coming out of a can of canned air? Yet, he convinced me, so I would suggest that it's not along YouTube. And there's in addition, right after it, there's an entry for Wikipedia for shock diamonds. And take a look at them, think of it, ponder it. And if you want to tell me that you still don't believe, next Sunday, I'd be more than happy to talk about it. Okay?
Are you sure it takes well over the speed of sound to create shock diamonds?
That is my understanding, that shock diamonds are a characteristic of airflow at hypersonic speed. Perhaps I'm wrong. I think I read it in Wikipedia as well, but you could double-check my work. I'm always more than willing to be told that I got it wrong.
Something to think about. I don't think I'm going to drop everything to research it, though.
Okay, I'm not saying drop everything. I just, if you happen to have a spare half hour and curiosity in that direction, feel free. I will give you the tools to do it rather easily. Again, you just type in roy.ac2gs.com, and it will be one of the links on the front page at the top. Won't be at the very top, because I made it kind of invisible for this puzzle to work. So I will reveal it and make it visible. And if you want to, check it out. If you don't want to, I understand. That's fine. Ed.
WA2VFM, just one other query with regard to what Ed said, Roy.
Yes, Bill.
when we first discovered that we were indeed discussing an aerosol can, I believe that it said that I don't believe the large volume of air from an aerosol can, but relatively speaking, wouldn't the amount of air coming out in the short burst of an aerosol can be a small volume of air rather than a large volume of air?
Well, it's all relative. I think the conceptual problem that Ed is voicing is he feels that the nozzle should be far narrower to possibly get at those velocities, and that would cut the airflow dramatically. So I guess he thinks that hypersonic velocities would require a physically impossible situation where you'd have to either increase the pressure inside the can or do something else. That given the pressures available in the can and the nozzle diameters and the amount of gas expressed out the nozzle, he thinks is not enough to provide enough speed increase to reach a supersonic speed. That would be my assumption.
And a key point is the pressure withstanding capability of the tin can.
Well, but the pressure is not that large in the can. It's just forcing that particular pressure through a very narrow nozzle that's accelerating the gas speed's velocity out of the nozzle.
If you make a sort of a straw that you blow into it, and it has a microscopic port at the end, you're not getting remotely there. You need a lot of pressure. I work with 3,000 PSI tanks, and they are very, very heavy from the wall business. I mean, you know, like a 4-foot tank, 8 inches wide, weighs like empty, like 50 pounds from all that steel. Those 20-pound barbecue tanks, I'm not sure what pressure they are, but they weigh 40 pounds full. It's 20 pounds of propane and 20 pounds of steel wall paper.
Okay, but again, we're kind of talking about the material that's in the canned air dispenser. I'm sure it propane will turn into a liquid if you cool it down to, I don't know, what, 30 degrees or something. I don't think you could liquefy the canned air. Well, you know, I guess actually if you invert it, it's under pressure. I don't know. Like I said before, anyone or everyone that has any kind of thought that I'm completely wrong and gone crazy, please watch the video, read the little Wikipedia about shock diamonds, and again, if you want to talk about it next week, I'm more than happy to. At this point, I don't know, discussing it without you guys kind of looking at the proof is kind of limiting the discussion. Jeff, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy, AC2PL. I'm willing to accept it entirely. I think that if you, it's kind of counterintuitive, but if you are accelerating a smaller amount of material to a large enough speed, the end result at the end of the nozzle is not going to be as much material, but it will have accelerated at quite high pressure at the end of the nozzle. And that's the thing, is that we talk about it when we all took physical chemistry, is that it's acceleration through a nozzle. And we're focusing so much on the physical chemistry at the time and all the calculations and the equations that we forget, yeah, you take gas at a certain pressure and it accelerates across the nozzle to a lower pressure state, right? So you have the pressure on the other side of the nozzle, why it accelerates. So, yeah, it's going to accelerate, and then, of course, it'll expand again in the nozzle after it gets past the aperture. But the thing that I was going to say is that we have fun with the Joule-Thompson coefficients, because if you do that with any other gas, it cools the tank down it might send it across the room, but if you do it with hydrogen, the actual Joule-Thomson coefficient, it heats up the gas and eventually ignites it and turns the tank, which is zipping around the room, into a rocket instead of just a tank under pressure QSO.
Yes, indeed. I remember when we discussed that months and months ago when someone brought up hydrogen. Actually, I think you probably missed last week. There was discussion of, and I don't want to start that conversation again, of electric vehicles and hydrogen-based cars versus hybrids and versus electric vehicles. So I guess it's a good thing you missed that one.
I was probably dozing off when it I must admit. But I'm a fan of not lithium batteries, but magnesium batteries. I think there's a lot to be gained from looking at other metals that have a lot of interesting properties. Anyway, with that, thank you very much for the problem. It was great, and I turn it back to Matt. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, as always, for participating. Thanks, everyone. I hope you had fun. Anyone with any other comments before we close this this portion of the technical net? Okay, I'll take that as another polite no thank you. And once again, thanks to everyone who participated tonight, who once again proved that we can survive any Super Bowl. So I thank you again, and it's 10:17, which is a nice time to turn things over to Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks, Roy, ACTGS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report, for the TechNet. And, yeah, I have a couple of topics that we can go through here. One of them being the NASA's new experiment with the Psyche mission. The Psyche mission is the one that was launched, I think it was in October, and it's on its way to the orbit of where Jupiter is. It's actually going to go to the Trojan asteroids that are located there at the L4 and L5 position. So it won't actually go into orbit around Jupiter, but it will visit these asteroids in the future, many years from now. But one of the tests that NASA did, I talked about this a month ago, beginning of January, was this laser optical test where they transmitted a signal from near Los Angeles, near Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they transmitted up in the direction of Psyche, and Psyche at the time, a month or so ago, was 10 million miles away. What happens is Psyche picks up that transmission of the of laser light. It's actually infrared that they're using, and it detects it, and then it reorients the transmitter on board the space station back toward Earth, which it did successfully, and what it did is got its own transmitter on board the station. The satellite has a 4-watt laser transmitter. That's all 4 watts. Where the one on Earth transmitting up to it had 5,000 watts. But the idea of that transmitter at 5,000 watts was for spacecraft to zero in where it had to transmit back down to. That hit the location around 7,500 miles in diameter with a laser. So it had to be very accurate from 10 million miles away. And it worked. They transmitted a pre-recorded message. It was a 30-second video of a cat and some other information to make sure everything worked. The idea is to have a signal that's 10 to 100 times more capable of transmitting data than RF. So it worked out very well. But now what they did is it's now 20 million miles away. It's already double that distance. And they also put a detector on one of the dishes. You know, they have the Deep Space Network. NASA has Deep Space Network antennas all around the globe, three different locations, really. They have it in California. They have it in Madrid, near Madrid, Spain, and also in Australia. So it's roughly 100 degrees off from one another. That's why you would have constant communication with all our deep space probes and spacecraft that are out there. So they decided to take a reflector and put it, you know, a laser reflector, put it in the middle of one of these dishes. They have a 112-foot dish out in Boswell, California, not too far from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, so it would be in with the same diameter, within that diameter of the transmitted laser from the spacecraft. Now, you know, on the first test, actually on the second test as well, what they did is they transmitted that signal up. When the signal came down on 4 watts, they sent it to the Hale telescope, also in California. And the Hale telescope was able to decode the photons that were coming back. And that's how they got the signal. But now they wanted to see if they could also receive on one of these dishes. Even though this is an RF dish, in the middle of the dish, they put this reflector. What's called glass reflector, the ability to reflect infrared light, and then they transmit that back up to another little detector, and they decode it. And sure enough, it was successful. They used the Deep Space Network 112-foot antenna to receive the signal from Psyche. And also, at the same time, it was transmitting RF, so they did both at the exact same time. Of course, the optical signal was probably 10 or 20, 30 times more data back than you're going to get with the RF. But it did work, and it shows that this capability is well on its way to being used in the future. Ultimate goal is, like, one of the goals is to eventually have a setup like this on Mars where you can transmit optical data all the way back from Mars to Earth on a regular basis, you know, to transmit, like, video. It would be fine with video. To do that on Mars with RF, it would be very difficult. You'd get very little video. You'd have to have it all compressed. Wouldn't that be easy? To give you an idea, there's some satellites out there that are just transmitting. They might do, 100 pictures they might take in one day, and they're happy to get 2 or 3 pictures back on RF. If you could have this on every satellite, you'd be able to get all the pictures you want back from these deep space satellites. Anyway, Roy took the picture that the wife had downloaded and put it onto his website. So if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, and you'd be able to see this one picture of this 112-foot dish, and sure enough, toward the center, you can see this little square that they have set up. It's not that big. It only looks like, you know, maybe a foot square or so. Sitting in the dish, almost dead center of the dish, and that's receiving the photons from 20 million miles away. Mars sometimes is, 30 or 40 million miles away. Sometimes it's over 100 million miles away. So they're going to need to be able to do this on a regular basis in the future if they're going to use it for Mars. And somewhere down the road, they'll test this again. Maybe when it gets out nearer to the goal of the Trojan asteroid near Jupiter. We'll see. I'll keep an eye on these tests. Very interesting to actually go from RF to laser. Any comments?
easy to feel great.
Yes, Jeff, go ahead.
I'm just curious as to what the difference in beam divergence is of the laser, or if it's an infrared, I guess, laser. The beam divergence of the laser, the optical beam, versus the whatever antenna system they're using for the RF communications, and what the power density difference is that would be expected after, you know, that sort of 20 million mile transit.
Yeah, they're measuring photons, they say. Yeah, but just very few photons are hitting the detectors. You know, but of course they're doing it at a, you know, fast rate. So, you know, that power is, by the time they receive it, it must be really, really, really low from what they're describing. The RF is of course, you know, they used to come back down on the X-band, roughly 8-point-something or other gig on the X-band. And the diameter, they said, is around 100 miles with the laser, no more than that. And RF, of course, is much wider. Much wider, you know. I didn't see any numbers on it, but my guess is probably 1,000 miles in diameter. One way or the other, both of them have to point to a very precise location. Not only at Earth and at Boswell, California, but they also have to predict where the Earth is going to be when they make their transmission or when they're receiving something. Because when they make their transmission, they have to know that, well, the Earth is going to be there 10 minutes from now. You know, not where the Earth is now, because, you know, it might take 10 or 20 minutes, depending how far away it is. I think in this case it's probably, I think, 10 minutes away. 8 to 10 minutes before the Earth would receive that signal. So, you know, I mean, if they went exactly where the Earth is at that time, they would miss it, you know. So it's a tough job. Not only that, the spacecraft is also moving. It's moving further away. It's also, you know, changing. It's actually in a solar orbit. So is the Earth. Well, these calculations have to be done, and they're actually getting very good at this type of thing. Back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, Roger. So are they steering the satellite as it's transmitting? Because it seems like, you know, it seems fairly incredible that you can steer a 1,000-mile wide beam over 20 million miles. That is really pinpoint accuracy. So they would have to be, steering the machine as it's transmitting as well. Just remarkable, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, RF, you know, I mean, they've done this plenty of times, you know, with deep space, you know, Galileo and Cassini out in the orbit around Saturn when that thing was going. So they're pretty good at transmitting exactly where they have to go, all the way back to Earth with this deep space spacecraft. But laser is a little different. It's more accurate. It's a lot less forgiving. So that's why they needed, I assume they'll always do this, but that's why they needed this 5,000-watt transmitter to from Table Mountain from California, needed to be transmitted up, and to the spacecraft. Now the spacecraft picks that up, and it's able to use that data that it's getting to adjust the transmitter, which is a 4-watt transmitter on the spacecraft. And they're not moving the whole spacecraft one way or the other. They're actually adjusting the scope itself Back to you, Jeff.
AT2PL. So they, it seems to me that transmitting, I don't know what they're transmitting up, but they really could get to them using RF or really any other means in order to tell the device where to steer to. Bidirectional communication, of course, is absolutely awesome. And I'm looking at the picture from Roy's website. It's really an incredible dish.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, they got them. They got a whole bunch in each location. Yeah, in California, and you know, near Madrid, and near Canberra, and Australia. There's some 40 different antennas of different sizes. They got a bunch in each location. What's fun? What I like to do is I like to go to the Deep Space Network, DSN. .com, but NASA DSN.com. The Deep Space Network. You put Deep Space Network in your computer, and you'll see what comes up. It's got all these antennas lined up in the three different locations. You know, California, Spain, and Australia, and it shows, you know, let's say you have two or three antennas in California working at the same time. It shows what ones are actually operating at this time, and they'll have different letters which ones they're transmitting to. So it might say, you know, Mars Global Survey, or it might say, Mars Global Survey is out. Or it might say Mars Odyssey. It'll give the letter for that, and then if you click on the spacecraft, it'll bring up the spacecraft, what the spacecraft looks like. It'll give you the information about the spacecraft, how far away it is from Earth, how long it takes for the transmission to get back and forth. It's pretty good. It's a fun Deep Space Network site. I don't know if you ever tried that, Jeff.
Absolutely not, but I will. It sounds absolutely amazing. And 4 watts, that doesn't sound like a lot to us, but that is a huge amount of energy, so I'm assuming that they're coming in very, very controlled bursts. The final question that I had before I shut up is there any possibility for some sort of unknown mass that's intervening that might have a gravitational well that steers the beam away from where it's supposed to go? Just sort of a sci-fi question.
Okay, like the light of a star coming by the sun, and it's deviated one way or another, going back to the Einstein test to prove his relativity, that the sun has mass and affects light. I mean, it would work if there was mass in between the two signals. You're right; it would actually move it to, you know, so fractionally, probably not noticeable between, let's say, 20 million miles, you know, or even. But, I guess if it had enough mass, I guess it would work. You know, now you bring up the power on these lasers. Like I said, 4 watts on the spacecraft. I still haven't seen what the 5,000 watt one looks like in California that's being transmitted up. And the data that came down, by the way, it was a pre-recorded picture of a cat, somebody's cat from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They loaded it onto the spacecraft before it went. And sure enough, it was a 15 or 30 second film of this cat walking around. And that's what they used as a test. This is all a test, by the way. This is not going to be for operational procedures, you know, for the spacecraft. that's not part of the plan. The plan is just to use RF. They think that they're sending something out there. Let's put one of these things on here and see how it goes. They've tested this. They've transmitted signals from the orbit of the moon. They have done that with laser a while back. They're currently running tests between Earth, a geosynchronous satellite that has one of these laser systems on board, and the International Space Station. They've transmitted up to the space station and back down. So in the future, this could be a regular thing. And they need it because there's more and more deep space probes going out there, and they all require the time of the deep space network. Like when I tell you about, you'll see, you know, half a dozen always working at one time. But, you know, there's literally 40 different possible satellites that they listen to or transmit up to. You know, like I mentioned this stereo satellite a while back. It was a stereo A and stereo B. A is still working, but once in a while you'll see, you know, one of the antennas transmitting up to it, you know, in operation. Voyager, same thing. I mean, that thing is, well, by the way, I think Voyager 1 is toast, but Voyager 2 is still going. You know, it takes, you know, Voyager 1, I think it was taking 30 hours to get up there and back. Another 30 hours back or something. You make a transmission for it to do something, and you got to wait a day and a half to get a response at the speed of light. Fantastic. All right, let me just go on to a different topic here. This WS2N. There's a spacecraft Juno I've talked about probably many times here on the net, including when it went up in 2011, when it launched, and that launched on an Atlas V rocket, you know, from Launch Complex 41 years ago. And Juno is a large spacecraft. It's got three big solar panels from end to end. It's probably 180 feet. The idea was to fly out to Juno and go into a polar orbit around Juno, which it did. It got there in, 2016 and so, and it's been in orbit, you know, for many, many years already. You know, the idea was to really study the planet itself. But as time went on, if it went nearer a moon, it would take pictures of the moon, and it had like 10 different instruments on board, you know, to test you know, everything from what the planet is made of, what kind of atmosphere it has, and, you know, basic geology. You know, it has that capability and great cameras. This past week, it did a very close flyby of Io. Io is one of the Galilean moons. You know, he named four of them. And Io is very close in to the orbit of Jupiter. And that one has active volcanoes as we speak. And we know this originally from Voyager that went past years ago. And the Galileo spacecraft that was in orbit around Jupiter probably at, 2.5-3 years, and they sent back pictures of the many different moons, including Io. So we know it has volcanoes. This one flew by at around 900 miles above the surface, which is very close. Had a good camera looking at it. It's also going to do it again, I think, in the not too distant future. But Juno did very good. Took good pictures. They sent them back, and I find it fascinating that this thing working, you know, all these years later. By the way, it's all solar panels. Like I said, no
RTGs, no nuclear radioisotope thermoelectric generator, just all solar panels. If it was in the orbit around Earth, it would be generating, I think, 12 or 14 kilowatts. But because Jupiter is so far away, it's down to just less than 500 watts, then it could charge batteries. But it's enough to operate that spacecraft. The spacecraft has two big batteries, two lithium-ion batteries, and each one is like 55 amp hours, so it's got plenty of juice. And it used to take around 58 days to orbit the planet, and they've cut down over the years down to around 40 days. Originally, they wanted to do it every like 15 days, and they were going to do it that way, but they realized they had a problem with one of the engines, and they were afraid if they fire that one engine again to get into that kind of an orbit, it might foul up the whole mission. They're worried about some kind of a leak where they might lose all their fuel and they won't be able to make adjustments in the future, or worse than that, they were afraid of an explosion. So they just left it in that kind of an orbit, and instead of doing science that they needed in, you know, X amount of time, they just extended that to months and even years, of course. Amazing. Runs on a 28-volt system, and it's got, like I said, 10 different instruments on board, including one called a radio plasma wave sensor. That one, Jet Propulsion Laboratory wanted to test out it went up in 2011. They wanted to test it out in 2013, and what they had planned on doing was seeing if it worked during its first pass around the Earth. See, when they launch, they go around, you know, in a solar orbit around the Earth. And after a couple of years, it keeps going around and eventually catches back up to the Earth. And then when it comes near Earth, they use Earth as a gravitational assist to help it send it out faster to, you know, eventually get to, in this case, Jupiter. So when it came around in 2013, they had the great idea to see if all the hands on Earth, see if you can get a lot of people, a lot of amateur radio operators, to transmit on 10 meters, and they wanted to transmit the letter, the word hi, H-I, you know, they wanted to do that over and over again. So they looked for volunteers in the ham community. Naturally, it came out in QST. They were looking for people, and people signed up, including me. So when the day came that everybody was going to transmit at the same time, see if this thing. Now, this is not a radio receiver. This is a radio. They call it a plasma wave sensor. It detects plasma, but they wanted to see if, you know, it would also be able to detect radio waves. They wanted to see if they could do that when they were near Earth. So they did, you know, everybody had a computer, you know, in 2013, and you just looked at the website, and they tell you, you know, push, transmit, you know, push it. I had a straight key here. Push the button for one dot for 10 seconds, and then they tell you to release for a certain amount of time, and then push it again for 10 seconds, and they tell you to release for a certain amount of time. What they have is, on the website, they had a green dot would light up, you know, you knew to push it. When that went off and the red one went on, you don't do anything. And then when the green light came on, you pushed again. So collectively, they put this all together, and they wanted to see if it worked. Months later, they finally evaluated everything, and they realized 4,000 hams that participated around the globe, it was successful. And eventually, they actually have a YouTube. You can look at the YouTube, and sure enough, they tell you all about it. And naturally, they compress
the CW, into, you know, where you actually hear it, instead of having each stop for 10 seconds. But they show you what the plasma detector, plasma wave sensor detected. That's pretty cool. And then they said if you want a QSL card from NASA, from Jet Propulsion, you know, you submit your paper, what you heard, blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, 6 months later, I wound up with a card in the mail. Anyway, I think I've told that before, that whole story on a couple of times. A lot of fun. Any comments? WS2R. I heard a transmission, and now I hear the ID. Anybody?
Casey to Bill Abel.
Oh, okay, that was you, Jeff. Go ahead.
Just so I'm clear, I'm a little fuzzy on the details. All of you hams, 4,000 guys transmitted at the same time and created a plasma effect in the ionosphere, QSL?
No, not in the ionosphere. In fact, they were worried about the ionosphere stopping the transmission on 10 meters at that time. But they figured if enough people transmitted, you know, I don't know if everybody got through. Yeah, I mean, some people were on the other side of the earth, but, you know, they didn't care. They said it might hit the ionosphere and come back around the other side. So they got everybody to do it at the same time. And it was actually, you know, RF going up, you know, into space and hitting their detector. I think they had like a dipole or something on the for the receiver for the plasma detector, and whatever, you know, they had there was able to pick up the RF. It's a plasma detector. It's not set up for RF. Not even designed for it. But they, by doing this, they were able to say, hey, look, if this works, you know, it's a good power plasma detector. This way, when it goes out to Jupiter, we know it's going to be able to, you know, well, we know it's going to be able to detect signals. We know it's working. So that was their goal. Anyway, back to you, Jeff.
Roger, I understand. So it's a plasma detector, but it's sensitive to a specific wavelength, if I understand. Plus or minus whatever Doppler shift.
Yeah, and Doppler had nothing to do with this in this case. They knew everybody was going to be pushing that button at the same time. And this went on, you know. They did it. I think we did it for, it seemed like about a half hour or so. Half hour, 45 minutes. We kept doing it. And I forgot now. I'll have to look at the YouTube and remind myself of how long it did, how long of the time it was. But, and then there was somebody else that used to check the news, not a lot. Kay did it as well. But, 4,000 people collectively, you know, I was transmitting 100 watts, you know. Yeah, maybe some people had a 1,000 watts, who knows. But collectively, if everybody transmits at the exact same time, this is what happens, you know. And apparently it worked. It definitely worked. So you could actually hear it. You could actually hear the other noises it was picking up too, this background noise that it just was picking up. But when the code was being transmitted, you could tell the difference, you know. They even showed the dots, you know, they have a graph going by. And as the graph goes by, you can see, you know, one dot, another dot, and you see the space, and, you know, and then you see the four dots. It's pretty good. Back to you, Jeff.
Hey, CTPL. Yes. I don't mean to be too much of a scientist, but the nice thing about these scientific experiments is that Yeah, they're verifiable. You get a readout and you can say, yeah, this is what it's from. What I want to know is, I guess I'm taking it back a step, but the picture of the cat. Were there 10 different cats that were sent up and the machine selected at random one to send back? Just so we know that it was an actual transmission instead of, stacking the deck. QSO.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was Tabitha's cat. Somebody at JPL had it. And there was other data that was coming back, too, from the spacecraft. That I have no idea what that was, but, they were testing other stuff to make sure, whatever test that they had, they said it was 100%. But, yeah, I know what you mean now. You could go to, the name of the spacecraft, Psyche, spacecraft, maybe cat transmission from space or something like that. There's a dozen websites that I put it in Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, and they have the whole transmission where you can see it. The guy sitting in front of their screens at JPL watching this thing. So, it was a real thing. Back to you, Jeff.
Extraordinarily cool. Thank you. AC to go.
Yeah, I mean, it'll take me a couple of minutes to find the website, but I'm sure you can find it. Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Psyche, laser test. I'm sure, I guarantee you're going to get 20 different websites to look at, and they're all like the same thing. Another flight that just went up the other day was something called PACE. PACE is a billion-dollar mission that finally got off the ground many, many years ago. 20 years ago, they wanted to send this thing up. It's a climate type of mission. Going to look at the water, actually look at the color of the water, and by the darkness of the water, and then they could tell everything, something with plankton, and all this information they were dying to get back. The scientists were pushing for this many years ago. But in 2018, they had an administration that wanted to cancel this. They were not interested in climate of any kind of climate satellites. They were just interested in manned space program, which is fine with me, but it was going to knock the scientists out of the box. And Congress had put so much into this particular mission, PACE, that no matter what the administration tried to do, these people kept bringing it back to life over and over again. And then, of course, now you have a different administration, and they went full blast on this thing. And they finally got it off the ground last week. And they're going to look at the aerosols and, the atmosphere itself, the clouds. This is a mission that they've been looking forward to many, many years. They call it the Plankton Aerosol Cloud Ocean Ecosystem. That's what I wrote down here for PACE. But I would imagine that, these guys are freaking out when it was going to get canceled. It's almost $1 billion that were poured into it, all kinds of equipment on board. It looks like a big satellite. It's in a polar orbit. It was launched on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket into a polar orbit. And from what I see, it's doing very, very good right now. So I was glad to see that thing get off the ground. For the scientists' sakes, I tend to go with the engineers more. I like the robotics and the different rocket engines that they're developing and all of that. The scientist part of it is pretty tough. They have a whole group of scientists that want all this type of information coming back, even when they go to different planets. And then you have the engineers, and they always fight each other because certain things that the scientists want, the engineers realize it's too complicated, it's going to cost too much money, they'll never get the thing off the ground, and they go back and forth. And eventually they find a common ground. Any comments? WS2N. Before I get any later, there is a launch that I want to talk about. I've talked about it many times before, so I won't bore you with it. It's called Nova C. It's going to be launched on Valentine's Day, the 14th. And that one's going to go to the moon. Has all kinds of stereo cameras on board for when it comes in for a landing. It's got another couple of cameras that I think are going to come out of the lander before it lands on the moon, take pictures of the craft itself as it lands on the moon. So we'll see. This is a NASA-sponsored spacecraft built by Intuitive Machines. And NASA, six different experiments on board. And it's a total of 12 different experiments. Some of them are private, commercial stuff. But this one is I think it's going to make it. it's a problem lately. These countries are, crashing on the moon left and right. Except India made it to the South Pole. And this one's going to also make it to the South Pole of the moon. And this company's, they're gung-ho. This is called Nova C, and it'll be the first one of the year. They plan on two more by the end of the year. So we'll see. And each one is more and more involved. And there's another one by Firefly coming out also at the end of the year called Blue Ghost. That should be a good one. A lot going to be happening. We'll be talking about going to the moon a lot. Anyway, I'm looking at the clock.
Time complete.
Getting to the witching hour, so let me sign. I'll turn this back over to Roy. Let me drop it. Tomorrow we have the club InfoNet. That's 8:30 on these repeaters, followed by Stop and Shop. And followed by Amateur Radio Newsline. Another thing that you might want to do is next week, Monday to Thursday, I don't know if you go all the way to Friday night, they have the school roundup. So, you make contact with the schools. It's sponsored not only by the ARRL, but also Weimark is the main one that's behind it. Blue N2RQ is really instrumental in keeping that school roundup system going. So naturally it's all HF, and schools make contact. Don't know what information you need to get. I was hoping Ken was going to be on or Lou to give that information, but it's on the website anyway. 5-9, got to give the state, the school, whatever it is, and Monday through at least Thursday. Anybody have any comments before I turn this back over to Roy? This is WS2N. Nothing heard. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS. This is Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all you do here on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate your presence here and your help. And I appreciate everyone else's participation. We competed against the Super Bowl. It ended about 5-10 minutes ago. It was in overtime. The Chiefs won, if you care. And I thank you all for choosing the Limar Technical Net. And I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned a few things. And I hope you were entertained. And I hope you'll join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. So our revels now are done. And as always, I like to end it with the closing comments that Dick made often in his technical net. Be kind to each other. It's always good advice. As well as the ancient Roman philosopher Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, and you don't have to agree with everyone on everything. Research it yourself, evaluate it for yourself, but keep an open mind as best you can. So thanks again to everyone. Be well. Have a good week. Enjoy yourself. And please, if you can, come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we'll try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I end it the way I usually do these days. Slava Ukraine.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.